This is Fresh Air. I'm Frank Browning. Writer and biologist Bill Jordan gets upset when he hears humans talking about how birds and animals resemble people. As though dogs, birds, and bugs were imitating their betters. Really, he says, we can learn a lot more about ourselves, from the rituals of mateship to making war, by looking at how human behavior is rooted in the insect and animal world. Jordan has written about behavior and evolution in a slim new volume of essays called Divorce Among the Gulls.
Evolution basically is about relationship and kinship. And the implication of evolution is that the more closely related you are, the more similar you are. But another implication is that animals that are related, that have descended in one way from another, they're sort of made out of used parts. Like for instance, when evolution wanted to make a bird, he had to take a lizard and make wings out of legs and that kind of thing. So evolution always uses used parts. And my premise is that the human brain has got to be an expansion of the animal mind, primarily of the ape mind. In fact, I think that really human beings are nothing more than exaggerated monkeys, and that's not to slur the monkey.
You talk a lot about you talk about sex and you talk about territory. Mm-hmm. Territory among medflies, even, or among apes. But tell us what it is that we can learn from the medfly on the leaf.
Yeah, that particular essay was called, I think, the Tender Macho Medfly Male or something like that. And it was about what's known as female choice. Female choice is now a whole area of research in ethology, in the branch of biology that deals with behavior. And it's been opened up by the influx of women into biology. Men sort of pioneered the field because at that time it was, science was primarily a male domain. And men always seemed to look for things like dominance and aggression and territorial defense, aggressive things. And women seemed to be attracted to nurturing things, to social interactions in groups and that kind of thing, male-female relationships. Anyhow, the medflies, it turns out, have a very, very typical system where the males get together in a place called a lek, a lekking site. And a lek is a collection of several males who compete, and they sort of establish a dominance hierarchy, a peck order. And then they put out mating pheromones, which seem to attract the females.
Now, pheromones are fragrances to the lake.
Fragrance, yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They're sexual scents, sexual odor. But anyhow, when they arrive, the dominant male, the one who has won all the battles and sort of ascended to the top position, has the dominant leaf in the middle of this little lekking area. And the females tend to go right to that leaf where he's located. Now, he clings to the underside of the leaf, and the female lands on the top. And he can see her silhouette through the leaf because his leaf always seems to have light shining on it. And the lekking activities occur, by the way, usually between like 9 and 11, and then maybe 2 and 3. And lighting seems to be very important to it. Anyhow, he can see her image, her silhouette through the leaf, and he starts emitting a different sexual odor. And he fans it with these slow, deliberate wing beats so that it wafts around the edges of the leaf and comes over the top, and the female then responds, and she crawls toward the edge, and if she likes what she smells, she crawls under the edge, and now she's facing him. And then he walks toward her, and they sit there face to face, and they start fanning odors back and forth, and probably communicating in other ways, maybe visual ways as well. And finally, if all the courtship steps satisfy the female, the male then does a sort of little vault and jumps onto her back, and stays there for a bit, and then he tries to copulate. And at any point, the female can sort of nix the proceedings. Well, if they get locked in copulo, you'd think that there's no more choice, but there is, because this is the importance of the mating occurring on the underside of the leaf. Anyhow, if at the last minute she doesn't like what she smells or feels or whatever, she just lets loose of the leaf, and the couple sort of tumbles down and they break apart. So the point is, the female can reject the male at any number of points in this courtship procedure. And it turns out that about 15% of these dominant males, these really sort of big macho guys that have won all the fights with males, for some reason prove unacceptable to the females. And so these
yes,
males...
Yes, and so what do we conclude here?
Well, the conclusion is that these males don't get to mate and their genes are not passed on. And so the females are actually shaping over the course of time, the course of evolutionary time, they are shaping the kind of male that they want. So because they simply can say, you're not going to mate with me, you know, Buster, and so your genes aren't going to go through me. And so his genes sort of get cut off, and eventually over time you get a male that has to be competitive among other males, or he won't get to the, you know, to the point of having a territory. And then he's got to also satisfy the female's demands. And of course this is all genetically carried, because medflies don't have intellect, they can't learn, there's no excuse. It has to be a part of their genetic constitution to have the right moves. And this probably occurs very, very commonly throughout the animal kingdom, and I suspect in the human world as well. It's something to look for, something to think about.
The thing to think about being that Rambo may make it through the jungle, but that doesn't mean he'll have any offspring.
Exactly. And it means that that in the human world, the female's ability to reject a suitor has probably had a very important part in shaping what men are today, just the basic nature of the male creature. And in that essay, I was sort of talking tongue in cheek about these various the kinds of ideal males that have been sort of held up by women in the last 20, 30 years. The very sensitive male in the 60s and 70s, and then this sort of narcissistic male that arose. And now, today in the 90s, they want, apparently a male who sort of can be tender and also tough. And it's kind of amusing to me, because that's just what the medfly females seem to want in their males. Sort of a balance of tenderness and macho toughness.
Too macho and they get popped off the leaf. Too tender, they don't make it onto the leaf.
Exactly.
It's a problem.
Yeah, it is. It really is. It's universal.
My guest is Bill Jordan. Mm-hmm. He has he's written a new book. It's called Divorce Among the Gulls. He calls it an uncommon look at human nature. We'll be right back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Bill Jordan is my guest. His book is called Divorce Among the Gulls, and there is an essay about Divorce Among the Gulls. Now, I suppose most of us as children were raised to believe that, among birds, couples are forever, and they're the model of true devotion. And, of course, we've begun to learn lately that, maybe that's not the case, and that birds sue for divorce as well, especially gulls. What does that mean?
Well, it's true that monogamy is very common in birds. We're finding out now that they're not very faithful. They do a lot of messing around on the side. But in the seagulls that were studied by my friend Judith Hand, she's a biologist, and they found that the gulls tend to mate for life. But over the course of time, it turns out that about 25% of the population end up getting what amounts to divorced. And you have to ask, your first question is, how can gulls be incompatible? I mean, this is just a strange thing. Well, it turns out that you look at the temperament of the gulls, and one of the ways in which temperaments can be incompatible has to do with how much the male and the female want to incubate the eggs. Because in seagulls, the males and females share the mating duties, they share the incubation duties, and the chick feeding and that kind of thing. And The title chapter of the book is called Divorce Among the Gulls, and it's about this one couple and one of their little marital disputes. And it has to do with the male and the female squabbling over who gets to incubate the eggs.
Who gets to sit on the eggs?
Who gets to sit on the eggs. And
doesn't seem like particular... something you'd want to fight over, does it?
No, it doesn't. but the gulls are sort of apparently it's a very sensual experience, a very pleasurable experience to settle down over the eggs. They have a patch of feathers falls out. It's called reveals a patch of skin called the brood patch, and the blood vessels come closer to the surface, and this allows the heat to pass directly from the body into the egg. And when you watch these gulls settle over the eggs, they throw their heads back and they shake their heads and they sort of settle down over the eggs, and they shake their tails, and it just looks like it feels so good. And in this particular essay, the female had to come back, and she goes through a ritual, sort of a greeting ritual, which also serves to say, look, I want to take over now. And the male sort of says, hey, I don't want to give the eggs up. And they go through about, 15, 20 minutes of this dispute. And finally, the male says, all right, he sort of, grumbles and leaves. And then the female settles down. But anyway, if you have a male who wants to incubate 70% of the time, and his mate also wants to incubate 70% of the time, they're going to be squabbling about 40% of the time. And that squabbling, if it's really violent, it can break the eggs or injure the chicks, or it can interfere with the foraging. The chicks won't get fed enough. The adults might not even get fed enough.
It's not good for family life.
No, not at all. And if this squabbling is bad enough, if they don't fledge the chicks, if the chicks don't grow up and leave the nest, the next year these couples tend to come back with different mates, and I think this seagull model sort of gives you a certain insight on the biological nature of incompatibility, and also it serves to make us realize the kinship, the similarities between us on these very basic levels. And I find that a very provocative and a disturbing and also a very sort of a heartwarming notion, that the idea of kinship, this relationship and similarity in these basic emotional areas.
I suppose it was when you were a student, a young biology student, that you began to get a little bit disturbed about the way in the dissecting lab we separate the animals whom we're carving up sometimes while they're alive.
Yeah, well, in the last essay in the book, it's called "Pictures at a Scientific Exhibition." There are four pictures, and the pictures being sort of very realistic descriptions of the way we were taught to kill animals and then work on them in the physiology lab. And also, it's about the attitude we were encouraged to take, toward the killing and the vivisection, the live cutting up. Now, this, of course, is central to our medical research and to agricultural research. We simply use animals, and we always say it's all right because it's in the service of human beings, which is a very self-centered thing. And by the way, this is why I believe we have to set ourselves above animals, because it gives us license to do with them as we will. One purpose of science, of scientific training, is to teach you how to separate your irrational mind from your emotional feelings. And I think this has to happen in certain ways. I mean, if you're a physician, you have to get past the revulsion of cutting live flesh. You simply have to, and you do it because you by telling yourself that it's something you have to make yourself do. It's in the service of a higher good, and it is. But at the same time, I think we should recognize that when we unleash that human reason, it has no loyalties. It has no compassion. It can go any direction that it tends to go. You can say, if I cut your nose off, look at that very interesting pattern of arteries. My goodness, that's interesting. But if you follow your natural reactions, you go, oh my God, you almost go into convulsions. It's so horrifying to you. So I think there's a real problem. We have to understand that the human rational mind is a real loaded gun. Because when you see life in this sense of kinship, and you realize how closely related all life really is, there's not that much. I mean, this chimpanzee, they think, has 99% of the same genes that we have, and yet we use chimpanzees in AIDS research. That's just pretty unconscionable. I mean, Stephen Jay Gould, I think somewhere in his writing, was saying it's conceivable that you could cross a chimpanzee with a human being and get an offspring. That shows you how closely related we are.
Human beings are also a part of nature, right?
Yes.
So it may be that there's a sorting out going on here. It isn't clear whether human beings will disappear or whether other species will, but I'm not quite sure why there is anything necessarily morally upsetting that some creatures are sacrificed by human beings' triumph, just as humans may at some point be sacrificed to other life forms.
Well, that's a good point. I guess I'm sort of falling victim to my own sort of human sense of what fair treatment is, basically sort of equal treatment. It's the basis of civil rights and the women's movement, the whole thing, the idea of treating people equally and fairly, and that upsets me. But you're right. In the larger sense, we're part of nature, and this is the way nature operates, and so it doesn't matter. It doesn't really matter.
I mean, if we can indeed save ourselves from AIDS at the expense of the chimpanzee, is this an immorality? Or it sounds as though you think it is, that somehow or other we die of AIDS than that the chimps should die in the lab.
Well, I mean, we have all the power, so we can say that we're the ones that should live and the chimps should die. But if the chimp had the power, it would reverse things. And I'm simply saying that by setting ourselves separate, we define ourselves as having the power, as being the top species on the ladder. And I don't think this is true in a real sense. It's just because of our we have the power and you're right. In terms of human morality, it's unfair. But in terms of this great sort of bland amoral system we call nature, no, it's not unfair. It's not bad. It just simply is. But if we want to live with ourselves as human beings, it seems to me that we should look at ourselves and say, well, this behavior is really pretty bad. I think we know deep down inside, many of us do, and we don't want to face it. It's one of these things that
we know what
we know that we're giving the world a pretty bad shake. But we find it so hard to control ourselves that we haven't been able to this point, and we're not very happy with ourselves about it.
My guest has been William Jordan. He's written a book called Divorce Among the Gulls, An Uncommon Look at Human Nature. I'm Frank Browning. This is Fresh Air.